this week's 51%, we'll listen to a conversation with the youngest female founder and CEO to take a company public.
I hope to be able to be a role model of a different type of entrepreneur.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. At age 35, Stitch Fix founder Katrina Lake became the youngest female founder and CEO to take a company public, and it happened in 2017. Online personal styling company Stitch Fix is now worth more than $2 billion. She has not only changed the way many of us shop for clothes, but she's also changing how we think about leaders. Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller spoke with Lake about learning to embrace her history-making role as the youngest woman to take a startup to IPO. Perhaps you saw the image of Lake at NASDAQ, standing with her son on her hip. Schiller spoke with Katrina Lake on stage at Inforum at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco.
So it's hard to say exactly when I came up with the idea, but, you know, some history, like I, growing up, like, you know, as a 10-year-old, if you asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would have told you a doctor. Like, it had never occurred to me that I should want to be an entrepreneur, that I would be a good entrepreneur. You know, you take all these, I forget what they're called, like a Myers-Briggs test. You know, you take these tests when you're growing up, and like zero of them told me I should be an entrepreneur. Like, my mom was a public school teacher here in San Francisco for a long time. My dad was a doctor, but always in the university system. He was here at UCSF for probably for 20 years or so. And so, you know, there is not like an entrepreneurial bone in my body. And so my journey was a little bit of an unconventional one, where I worked at a consulting firm. I did that kind of out of indecision because I thought I wanted to be a doctor, but I wasn't ready to do that yet. And so I worked at a consulting firm and was lucky enough to kind of stumble into the retail and restaurant practice. And that's where both retail and restaurant I love, because I was like, they're just these big, meaningful categories. And so, you know, the journey was more like I love those categories. And I was like, and I want to work at whatever is going to be the future. And I spent a bunch of time looking to join that company. And so I interviewed a bunch of places. I almost took a job at Starbucks. Ultimately, like, didn't quite feel like that was exactly it. And then I worked at a venture capital firm thinking, okay, this is going to be a great way for me to meet the person who's going to create the future. And so I went and met with, you know, 100 entrepreneurs in my 2 years there, and, you know, didn't meet the person that I thought was going to be the future of retail, but got to meet, you know, 100 people who were all like pretty normal people who were not qualified to be an entrepreneur. And and I realized that, like, you know, any person could be this. And I think, you know, you get exposed to the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Steve Jobs of the world, and, you know, you don't have in your frame of reference, that could be me. Yeah. And, you know, by meeting 100 people, you meet a lot of different types of people. And so I realized I could do it. And so, you know, I think I was really on this journey of, I just want to work at whatever company is reinventing retail in the future. And the formation of Stitch Fix was really just realizing that, like, if I believed there was a different future out there, like, I could start it.
Just create it. Just make your own future.
So that was the beginning.
So were you always a shopper? I mean, you know, from an intellectual standpoint, it was interesting to you, but in terms of your own personal, you know, was that something that you either hated doing or loved doing, or?
Maybe both. I don't. I have a sister actually who's here. She's not the shopper either. But, we have the sister who's the age in between us. She was a shopper, and so you know, she was the one who was definitely always the expert. She was always the one taking the fashion risks, and Natalie and I were probably more of the followers and taking her hand-me-downs. But I still loved, and what I think even people who hate shopping can resonate with, is like, there is nothing better than being able to feel like you have clothes in your closet that you love. And there is nothing better than putting on an outfit and being like, this is a great look. Like, there is nothing better than that feeling. And so, you know, I think I really love that. And I love the ways that clothing could contribute to that. My middle sister literally will, like, she would spend her free time looking at, like, the new arrivals on websites. And, like, that's not really how I spend my free time.
So now you just have a company that has a combination of machines and people doing that for you.
Right.
For,
well, and I think that's part of the inspiration too, is that like there are people who love doing this and who are experts and know everything and in their free time love to do this. And wouldn't it be great to be able to create a job for people like that? And so, you know, that actually ended up being part of the inspiration too.
So how important was going to business school in creating this idea?
So for me, it was important because, like I wasn't this super risky entrepreneur type who was gonna, like, I was never gonna quit my reasonably well-paying job and like have a gap on my resume. Like that was not something I was comfortable doing. And so, for me, it was important because it created this 2-year period of time where I could take this risk. And so I went to business school and my plan was to have a company off the ground, paying myself a salary, paying back my student loans the day I graduated. And if I wasn't able to have a business idea that was good enough that someone was going to give me money, if I wasn't able to have an idea that I wanted to do so that I would, you know, want to spend so far 7+ years on, then, you know, the worst case scenario is like, well, I have this MBA and I can go work at a great company. And so, you know, I saw it as kind of a risk reduced way to start a company. And so, you know, for me, it was really important because I have a hard time imagining how else I would have been able to find kind of a 2-year time period like that.
Well, I'd love to talk a little bit more about this idea of risk, because I think people do, you mentioned this a few minutes ago, that people have this idea in their head that entrepreneurs are these massive risk takers and they, you know, anything goes. And in fact, I saw a book just earlier today that said how to raise an entrepreneur. And it was like, teach them to take risks, you know, like all these things that just go counter to what the actual common wisdom is about how you start a successful business, which is not necessarily to just, you know, let it all fly. So can you talk about your mentality around that and what you've run up against in terms of the perception of what an entrepreneur should be?
So first of all, like, I think I am a good leader and a good CEO. And I don't know necessarily that I was a great entrepreneur, to be honest. And, you know, it wasn't kind of where my comfort zone was. Like, I don't sit back, and you'll meet some founders who get to this stage of the company and they yearn the scrappy phases again. And they just, they like the building part. Like, you'll hear that from people. And I did like it, and it was really fun and crazy. But, you know, I don't know that that's the part that I feel like I thrive in. And, you know, we'll probably talk about this later, but like, you could also argue that I wasn't good at it. Like, you know, we've built a $2 billion company using 40 million of capital, not because I was like, oh, I want to raise as little money as possible. Like, it was because I could not raise more than that much money. And so if, you know, in today's world, a good entrepreneur is the one that can raise the most money and hire the most people and buy the most time. And like, you could argue I wasn't good at those things. And, you know, ultimately was actually good at creating a company, which is maybe different. But I hope to be able to be a role model of a different type of entrepreneur, because I think there are lots of women and men out there that, you know, might be thinking to themselves like, well, that's, you know, that's not for me. Like, I can't see myself being that crazy out there person. And I felt the same way. And I think ultimately, like, I actually think I'm good at this job. And I don't know that I would have discovered it had it not been for kind of the convoluted path that I took.
Mm. When you talk about Stitch Fix, I've heard it talked about as a fashion company, a technology company, the intersection of fashion and technology. What is it?
I mean, it is both. And I mean, my theory on the whole thing is just like, I think the world is, we are going to a place where like being a technology company will be table stakes for you to exist. And, you know, the idea of a tech company doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Like, I think Facebook is a marketing company, Uber is a transportation company, Airbnb is a hospitality company, and we sell clothes. Like, that is our business model. And I think the reality is, like, if you want to be around 10 years from now, if you want to be successful 10 years from now, all of us are going to have to be technology companies. So technology is certainly, you know, what is differentiated about Stitch Fix, what is, I think, what is very special about Stitch Fix. But at the end of the day, like, the business that we're in is retail apparel. Like, actually, I just heard that on the analyst side, on the investor side, that Tesla has now been moved into the auto category, which makes sense. They make cars.
Where were they before?
They were in technology. Uh-huh. And so there's this weird catch-all bucket of people who've used technology as a differentiator that, like, I think you're going to see more and more of that migrate back into, right? And even Stitch Fix is a stock, like, recovered by mostly tech people, actually, and then a couple of retail people. And, you know, I think you'll see more and more people recognizing that, like, hey, these businesses are, like, you know, they're the same business as they were before, just powered by technology in a way that we didn't see before. So, you know, I think we're both, but I think the Marcation 10 years from now will probably be retail.
Yeah. So you had these big goals for yourself coming out of business school. Did you meet them right away? I mean, you wanted to pay yourself a salary. You wanted to have a sustainable business.
Not right away, but I was, I mean, I really wasn't going to do this if I wasn't paying myself a salary and paying back my student loans. Like that wasn't just like that wasn't an empty promise. Like I really wasn't going to do it. I was very committed. And so I spent a lot of my second year in business school out here. I spent probably a week or so a month, like sleeping on people's couches and like, and so I was able to get a term sheet from Steve Anderson, who's a seed investor, who is one of the first investors. I saw Kevin on the sizzle reel. Kevin was actually my, like a reference check for Steve, the investor. He was the first investor in Kevin at Instagram. And so I was lucky enough to kind of meet him early on. And so he gave us, you know, what would now be considered a very small seed check of $500,000. And so we closed that in April of 2011, started shipping fixes in that month. And then I graduated in May and then kind of moved everything out here in June. I guess we closed the money a month before I graduated. So maybe I got in just under the wire. We didn't have a sustainable business model yet at that point, but I was able to pay myself a salary, pay rent, hire some people. And so, I think the other part that was important to me too, and the investor thing was, yes, it was important to raise money, but I think it's also important to have, somebody who believes in you invested in the business. And so there's a lot of, I think confidence and credibility that comes from the fact that an investor who's met a lot of entrepreneurs and seen a lot of companies believes in the business. And, you know, I think one of the things that you can do as an entrepreneur is delude yourself into really, really believing in something. And sometimes that's great. And sometimes it's not reality. And so, you know, having investors involved, I think also helps, to build confidence that like this thing is real and it's possible.
Mm-hmm. How many no's did you have to hear before he said yes?
The seed was relatively easy, I would say, of just like, I think fundraising at Stitch Fix has always been either really hard or really easy and nothing in the middle. With him, I had worked with this woman, Sue Kinderson Cassidy, who had been an advisor of mine and a mentor of mine, and she introduced me to him. And so that part worked out well. But basically, he was like, he gave a term sheet for $750,000. He was going to put in $500,000, and he said, go find whoever else to fill in the rest of the $250,000. And so I probably talked to, 20 or so people, and everybody else said no. And I was very freaked out that, like, is he going to get cold feet when I go back to him and say nobody else wanted to? And, you know, he actually said, and I think he meant it, he was like, I'm glad that nobody else did. I'm happy to put in the other $250,000. And I was, oh, great.
That's amazing.
He was like, it just makes me even happier to see something when other people don't see it, is kind of the way he put it. And so that round we got done. Later rounds, I think, were a little bit more difficult.
Did he tell you what it was he saw? I mean, what it was that made him believe in you?
I mean, at that stage, you know, anybody can come up with this idea. Like anybody can come up. And Stitch Fix has this great product market fit because, like, when you tell people, like, wouldn't it be great if you could fill out a style profile and have a stylist who would send things to your home, and then you can try things on at home and just pay for what you keep? Like the concept is so strong itself that, you know, I think we benefit from having a lot of just natural product market fit from it. But the flip side of that is anybody can think of that, and anybody can pitch that to an investor. I think with Steve, it was really about like, you know, am I going to be the right person to do it? And honestly, like I had no experience that should have led him to believe that I was credible. Like I had no entrepreneurial experience whatsoever. I had, you know, no network of engineers and whoever else to draw from. But for whatever reason, he felt like I was going to be the one to be able to do it.
Well, congratulations to him and to you for that. I want to go back to you maybe being a doctor at some point when you were 10. So I understand that your mom came to America from Japan to go to graduate school. Did she have that immigrant mentality of like, my daughter must achieve absolutely everything to, you know, live up to the expectations of our new American family? Or, I mean, did you run into any of that as growing up?
both of my parents really believe that succeeding in school, that having a great education would open doors. And so I think that element was definitely very much ingrained. And my mom immigrated here from Japan for graduate school. And so we spoke Japanese growing up. And so in San Francisco, there are schools you can go to so that you can keep up with the Japanese curriculum, because Japan has a national curriculum. And so every Saturday, until I was in seventh grade, I think, every single Saturday and then every day in the summer, I went to Japanese school. So I had, that's like a lot of days of school, if you think about
it. That is, did you?
Of 365 days, like the vast, vast, vast majority of them were spent, I basically had every Sunday off. It was so funny too, because it was in the 90s. And so, everybody thought Japanese was going to be so useful. And and it's still useful when I'm in Japan or occasionally in a Japanese restaurant in San Francisco. Yeah. but it wasn't quite the business unlock people thought it would be. On the family side, like I was very, I don't think I've realized this until kind of being an adult and actually really in the last few years, but I had a lot of exposure to women in my family who'd done amazing things. Part of it is my mom, immigrating here and, not knowing English. And she didn't learn to drive until she'd had two kids in San Francisco. And she was like, well, the bus isn't going to work anymore. And I have to figure out how to drive. And so, of that is kind of amazing. And then, the other one is on my American side, actually on my Caucasian side, my great grandmother. So it was my grandfather. My grandfather was raised in this very unusual household where my grandfather was basically his mom and her sister both lost their husbands. And this was before welfare. It was before there were social services that were available. And so what these two sisters did was they were like, well, like we're just going to create a household. Like I think they had, I need a fact check. I think they had four or five kids between them. And they were like, we're just going to combine our households and one of us is going to go to work and the other one is going to stay home with the kids. And two sisters are going to raise these kids together. And so my grandfather was the youngest of those. And so he had been raised by these two strong women. He'd never even known his dad. And so like to be able to have these examples in your life of like people doing, anything that I achieve is never going to be as amazing as the things that they did. And it's just a great example to be able to have in your life, because I think it opens up kind of what's possible in a way that is, I really appreciate.
I mentioned at the very beginning of this the iconic photo of you at the NASDAQ with your son on your hip. And it was a head turner, and are you tired of headlines that focus on taking your company public and being a new mom? Or just recently there was a headline, Stitch Fix CEO Katrina Lake talks about leading a public company and her upcoming maternity leave.
My perspective on it has changed over time. So I had some pride about me, I think, that prevented me from embracing that early. And, this is more on reflection of like looking back and thinking like, well, why did I not think I could be an entrepreneur? And now I just think it's so important. And so even if it's just like, I'm just an example, like I think it's good and I'm happy to be that example. And like I said, I hope there's going to be many more people after me that can, it's totally normal for like, there's just these weird conversations around like, well, what do you do with earnings when you're on maternity leave and you're a public company CEO? There are all these things that like, I don't really know what the right answers are. And, I'm going to try to figure it out. But there just need to be more, I think just having more examples of what, different types of stories look like and different possibilities look like is super important.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those sort of can't win situations in some ways, right? Because like Marissa Meyer got dinged for only taking a couple of weeks of maternity leave. And you're probably going to get dinged for taking the entire maternity leave. I mean, it's like...
Well, and these situations are all really different because, I think when Marissa Meyer was in her place, like I think she had like activist shareholder issues. She had, she had a company on fire situation. And so, was that the right thing to do when your company is on fire? And this is the problem, is that there's so few examples that like I was with a public company CEO literally last week who has a 6 week old at home and he is taking his paternity leave. And so he was like happy to meet me at brunch, like wearing like golf clothes and shorts and he was on his paternity leave.
Yeah.
So like, I think all of these situations are unique and, you can't fault, I think, one person for having a different choice, but the challenge is that there's really only two situations now that you're going to be able to look back on. And, you know, if, I think for many other men, there's hundreds. So, you know, hopefully this can add to what people think of as, you know, what are my options when I'm in this situation?
So where's your husband in all this? Does he like, it used to be like, I remember, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, like Carly Fiorina, like when she was running HP, the whole story was about how her husband was at home taking care of the baby. And that's how it made it, they made it possible because they inverse the typical relationship. So do you and your hubby ever talk about, you know, divvying up the responsibilities so you can both do your thing?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely do. And he's not, you know, he's not at home taking care of the kids as his job full time. That's not like we have a nanny and she's wonderful. And so, but that being said, like, you know, and I think to myself, like, am I being sexist in thinking this? Because like, it's less about this year. Like I travel quite a bit, but as I think about next year and I think about, we're going to have two kids and one's going to be a toddler and one will be an infant. And I have this like enormous guilt around like, oh, that seems really hard. And for me to be traveling and leaving him to deal with two kids at night, even if he's not taking care of them during the day, like it's a lot of work at nights and the mornings. And I would like think to myself, like, am I sexist in thinking that? Because there's many, many men before me that had wives that traveled and left their two kids with their wife and probably didn't think twice about it. And I still like, I still haven't figured out like, how are we going to do that next year? And so, you know, I think I'm very, very lucky and grateful that I have a husband that's very supportive and a husband that, you know, probably takes more of the mornings and nights than I do. But I do, and I do think like in this world, like it does take, you know, it does take somebody who is willing to kind of put in, you know, a little bit more, I think, to, and, you know, I don't think it's necessarily that you need somebody who's going to be like a complete, you know, kind of stay home parent or anything. But I do think like the reality is that it's hard. And, you know, the reality is like there's sacrifices that one or the other is going to be making every single day. And then just, you know, trying to figure out how you can do that and then have a healthy relationship with your kids and a healthy relationship with your spouse. And, you know, it's all puzzle pieces that aren't super easy.
Yeah. Well, what do you look for? Because I know you're involved in a few things that are female focused in terms of investments. And I've got the Female Investment Fund, something called Moving Forward, which is about diversity. But in terms of when you now look at other companies that are looking for investments, what do you look for?
What do I look for? I mean, I don't do a ton of investing, but I mean, it is really important to me that founders that I meet and kind of companies I'm involved in are committed to building diverse teams. And I think one of the bigger challenges of why we see so little diversity at the top and at technology companies is because so often founding teams are built by repeat founders who go back to their network to build the team. And so they're just perpetuating this kind of lack of diversity that has existed in the industry for 20 years. And, you know, no one's putting up a job posting for a co-founder. Like, you know, you're just drawing from people in your network. And so, so I think, you know, as I have the chance to meet with founding teams, like I push on it a lot. I push on it with their board. I push on it with, you know, I've noticed you don't have any women on your founding team. What is your commitment on that? And so, you know, I think that's an area that I think helps to make companies better. And I think also kind of creates a better ecosystem for all of us.
That was Christina Lake, founder of Stitch Fix. She was speaking with Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller, produced at KALW in San Francisco. You can hear other conversations at inflectionpointradio.org. Republican U.S. Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn could make history by becoming the first woman elected to the U.S. Senate from Tennessee. She is running against Democrat Phil Bredesen, a former Tennessee governor who says he always has been very interested in seeing women get ahead. But he adds that doesn't mean Blackburn deserves to automatically win their closely watched contest to fill the seat left open by outgoing Republican Senator Bob Corker. Bredesen's camp recently announced the launch of the Women United for Bredesen Group. The campaign within a campaign aims to highlight issues important to women, such as health care costs for families. NBC Sports will televise the final round of the Augusta National Women's Amateur from the home course of the Masters. The club announced the creation of the women's golf event earlier this year. NBC will show the afternoon April 6th final round, the Saturday before the Masters. CBS televises the Masters. It will be the first time for women to compete at Augusta National in Georgia. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website, at WAMC.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1522.